This is the Annex Sociology Podcast. I'm Joe Cohen from Queens College.
I'm Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University.
And I'm Gabriel Rossman from UCLA.
We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Today we sit down with Fabio Rojas from the University of Indiana Bloomington. Fabio is a leading public sociologist who co-edits Context magazines with Rashawn Ray, also former B-Side podcast guest. He's one of the discipline's foremost bloggers at Org Theory. He's probably best known for writing From Black Power to Black Studies, How a Radical Social Movement Became an Academic Discipline with Johns Hopkins. And more recently, Fabio published Theory for the Working Sociologist with Columbia University Press. We're going to talk about public sociology, new media, Black Studies, student activism, and a lot more. You're not going to want to miss this.
Okay, so wait a minute. You called Fabio a public sociologist, and I'm curious to hear whether Fabio would describe himself that way, because to me, public sociology means something more specific than just somebody, a sociologist with a relatively large public profile. Like specifically, it means like Burroughs' whole, you know, we're going to engage in praxis type agenda.
Ooh. Fabio?
Right. So, I respect Professor Burroughs quite a bit. And in his version of public sociology is certainly tied to a specific normative agenda, mm-hmm. right? You know, he explicitly says, you know, that you have to be critical of society, often coming from a very radical or kind of Marxist perspective. He makes this very clear in his ASR article, which was a version of his keynote address as ASA president. And, you know, while I respect that, and I think that's a valuable thing to have, I don't think that covers all forms of public engagement between scholars and the rest of society. So I'm kind of flattered that you called me a public sociologist. That's certainly nice to hear. I don't think maybe I would fit Professor Burroughs' definition, and that's okay. But I definitely do believe in bringing science to the public, and there's a couple of good reasons for that, which is that, first of all, the public has paid for our research through tax dollars, if you're at a public university, through grants made for research or private donations. Tuition dollars as well go towards academic research. And it would be a very bad thing for us to take all that money and not tell anybody about what we've done. There are also some other reasons why public sociology would be a good thing. For example, if you happen to do research that has public relevance, this may not apply to, say, people who study poetry or quantum mechanics or something like that. But if you're a sociologist who studies, say, divorce rates and you know something important about divorce, you should probably tell the public about it. And then also, I think it's good for the health of academia in general to have a constant engagement with the public, to always balance what we care about within our own tribal disciplines with what may matter to everyday people. And that is certainly a valuable thing to do. So I definitely consider part of my work public sociology, even though it may not be in the definition that Gabriel alluded to.
Is that kind of, does that type of philosophy guide the work you're doing at Context right now? Like, what's the agenda with Context?
Oh, absolutely. The agenda with Context, at least as far as Rashawn and I are doing it, is to make it a bridge between the discipline of sociology and the wider public. So, for example, one thing that we're doing during our tenure is a new section called Policy Briefs, where we invite one leading scholar to review some area of scholarship or research on a particular issue, and then to offer a for or against that policy. Our first one was done by Paula Lance, who is one of the deans at the University of Michigan Ford School of Public Policy, and she wrote about at what age people should be allowed to smoke. Ted Gerber at the University of Wisconsin wrote about the issue about whether giving aid to Eastern European countries for democratization is a good thing or not. We had a really great feature on FOSTA, which is anti-trafficking legislation, and our author, she argued against it, saying that trafficking laws often conflate kidnapping and human slavery with sex work, and that's a bad conflation to make. And then our upcoming one will be by George Farkas, who is going to write about special education and minorities. So in terms of public sociology being a motivation, is definitely a motivation in context. Well, we're asking scholars to say, what's your best stuff? What's an interesting thing? Can you write in a format that other people would care about and that can be transmitted to the public at large? And that is 100% what context is all about.
That sounds awesome.
Now, kind of the issue with context, and this is by no means restricted to you. This has been since day one. You know, mm-hmm. How old is the magazine? About 15 years old?
Yeah, about 2001 or 2002 is the first year. That's right.
Okay, so like it's always been pitched as this is going to be our Psychology Today or something like that. This is going to be our popular crossover magazine. But, you know, the circulation is not exactly the Atlantic Monthly. And it's not priced at that price point, and it presumably doesn't have that kind of newsstand circulation. So in what sense is it reaching public crossover? Is it just like there's a period where there's no paywall and it gets Twitter traffic during that period? Is it that journalists who might work for the Atlantic Monthly pick up articles in context and kind of rewrite them for public audience? In what way does it actually engage the public?
Yeah, so that's a really great point, and you've put your finger on a very important issue. And the issue is this, which is that public outreach doesn't happen by itself. Yeah. It takes a great deal of thinking and strategizing to make it work. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So the bad news is historically we've had relatively low circulation numbers, but there's also a lot of good news. Yeah, it'll be phenomenal. So we're not quite there yet. We need a little bit of extra help to make that happen. And the way we make that happen is that for 30 days after the release of each issue, all of that issue of context is 100% free. You can download the entire magazine for free. Then after 11 months, then it becomes free forever. That's part one. So we have a lot of time in which you can download it for free. Number two, we have a website where we can continue dialogues or have shorter timely pieces. And that really increases the outreach to a larger audience. Number three, we recruit people who can be bridges between academia and the public. So for example, in our first issue in the winter, our first two interview subjects were Arlie Hochschild, who's great at communicating with the public, and Melissa Harris Perry. Then in the spring issue, we interviewed an artist named Ayanna Jackson, who was a sociologist as an undergrad, but now making a big splash as a photographer. And also that issue had Tino Cuellar, who is a justice on the California Supreme Court. So he's talking about the challenges that come with being on an appellate court like that. Cornel West was our summer interview. And then this coming fall, I'm really pleased to announce that we're going to have two absolutely fabulous interviews. One is with Mario Small, sociologist at Harvard University, who can talk about his book, Someone to Talk To, and also Viet Nguyen, who won the Pulitzer and MacArthur Prizes as a novelist. So in addition to making sure things are free for download, we have to have A-plus quality content. Gabriel, you also mentioned, you know, things like newsstand circulation. Mm-hmm. That's an important issue that actually we're working on. I can't make any promises now, but when you publish with an academic publisher like Sage or Oxford University Press, that is not terribly conducive to newsstand circulation because they don't have all the channels for getting things bundled with distributors and so forth. That's going to take some extra effort, and we're working on it, and we'll see if we can do something with it. But your comment is well taken, and we're working on it. But until that happens, we got fabulous free content. We have a great website. We have a Twitter presence. Rashawn started an Instagram, so if you want to Instagram us, you can do that as well.
Now, do both of you have to make fish lips, or just him?
Just him. He's a better looking man than I am. You don't want to see me. You don't want to see me. I'm nasty.
You don't have the daily fanny pack shot.
No, my beloved aunt, she gave that to me so many years ago. I missed that fanny pack. But, you know, really maxing out the social media. And then you also spoke about, like, who is the target for this, right? So at the very least, you have to get your own house in order. So we want every person in the sociological profession, whether it be an undergraduate, a grad student, or faculty member, to know this is a magazine for them and about them and presents them in a positive light and brings their best research to the public. But also by getting people like Melissa Harris-Perry and Cornel West to do interviews with us, we hope that'll draw attention to the journal, start building the bridges. The policy briefs are getting spoken about and they're starting to circulate. And these are different strategies to start building those bridges. We'll see in the long run how much it sticks, but you're not going to know unless you try.
Well, the leaky paywall sounds like a good policy.
Oh, it's a fantastic policy. And, you know, see, we're thankful to Sage for making that happen.
I have one more question for you, Fabio.
Sure.
Can you give us some sense of what is the right kind of submission for somebody who is interested in putting their work in context? What are you looking for in terms of pieces to publish?
Yeah, so the first thing to remember is that we want the opposite of most academic journals. You know, you're not here to impress people with your esoteric identification strategy. You're not here to show that you know more Bourdieu than everybody else. You're here to explain in clear and colloquial English. You have something to say from your research, or maybe you're writing an overview of other research. It has to be something accessible to general educated readers. So I tell people, you know, think of something like the New York Review of Books. Think of The Economist magazine. You know, something that's a little bit more highbrow, more intellectual, but still eminently readable. That's number one thing. Number two, please remember our format. You know, going along with the accessibility, there's also length. We do not do the 10,000, 15,000 word item. Context feature articles tend to be about 3,000 words a pop, and other sections of the magazine are about 750 to 1,500 words a pop. So it's got to be shorter. And number three, remember your presentation of self, that, you know, why should somebody read this? Tell us about how this is your research or your experience, and then learn how to make the segue into scholarly rigor, right? To say, you know, this is the topic that I care about. This is why you might find it interesting. Now, in very clear and simple English that your grandmother might explain, might understand, you know, this is why this is a valuable piece of knowledge and not just my op-ed editorial writing.
So you mentioned the feature versus the other articles. My understanding is that the features are in some sense peer-reviewed and the others aren't. Could you tell us more about what gets peer-reviewed and what the peer-review process looks like?
Oh, okay. That's a great question. So Context Magazine has something like six or seven different departments. I'll just focus on a couple of them. The core are called feature articles. Those are like 3,000, 3,200, 3,500 words. They're meant to be scholarly but accessible. You can talk about data. You're not going to have a whole data section, but you might have a couple sentences or a paragraph talking about where you got your evidence from. That's meant to be a representation of a more serious scholarly enterprise that you've completed. Those are peer-reviewed in a traditional way. However, we've taken the sociological science approach to peer reviewing, which is basically, we're not quite at their end of the spectrum, but we're close to it. We do tons of desk rejects. So if we're just not into it, no harm, no foul. We'll just tell you politely, you know, we're going to move on. We're not going to jerk you around. There's only one round of peer review, and we'll get a couple of external readers to look at it. And we bug them very quickly, so hopefully you'll get reviews back in like a month or 2 months, sometimes even shorter than that. And then Rashad and I make a choice. Either we will accept this conditional on revision, or we will reject it. There will be no second or third round R&Rs, nothing crazy like that. And then the most painful part of the process is actually not peer review, is working with Fabio and Rashawn. Because unlike regular journal editors who will say, here's, you know, reviewer one said X, reviewer two said the opposite of X, you figure it out. We don't do that. Our attitude is we are editing. The ASA has entrusted us with this publication because they value us and value our opinion. We're not dictators, but we do have an opinion, and we will tell you, like, please fix it this way. And the review process is only complete after you've made your corresponding editor happy. And that means I will go in and I'll rewrite chunks of your article for you if I think that will make it better. So for some authors who are very good public writers, they require a minimal amount of editing. I approve it and it goes to a copy editor. But then there have been some people where I'm just like, well, you're just going to have to switch this around completely. And I've rewritten entire paragraphs for them to show them how to do it. And that's what I think editing should be about, is like, we have a mission. We want it clear, wonderful articles that you could show your mom and dad. You could show your member of Congress or whatever. And that requires a lot of interventionism at the level of writing. And that's like a key difference.
So here's a banter bit that I've been waiting to do for a while. It kept on getting bumped, but now it seems like the perfect time. Last month, I think it was, I read a post on org theory by Fabio Rojas about elitism and sociology. Fabio, would you mind if I read it, or would you like the honors?
Why don't you read it? Because your voice is nicer than mine.
Oh, you're too kind. All right. The post says, over the years, commenters have asked, why focus on the most elite programs in academia? The answer is simple. Students and faculty in elite programs get disproportional attention, rewards, and influence. Is that fair? No, I definitely think that we can be more equitable. But as an empirical matter, academia is a superstar market, and I have to deal with that. For example, when it comes to gender and racial diversity, I always tell people that the action happens around elite programs. Why? Graduates of elite programs are most likely to stay in academia, get good academic jobs, and continue publishing. A lot of programs will simply not hire people below a certain PhD rank, at least not until they amass a massive academic record to, quote, compensate, unquote, for their PhD program. I have no animus against people with non-elite backgrounds, and I do think we need to help scholars across the academy, but if you want your local university to have a more diverse faculty, you'll have the best shot by focusing your efforts on the fancier programs. Just saying. So that's the post. And my question that I have is, does the discipline obsess over elite programs? Is it warranted? Is it helpful? Or does it hurt the discipline?
One of my favorite sayings about sociologists is that they tell you how unfair labor markets are, and then they show you.
Yeah, exactly. So
do we do it too much? It's unclear. So for example, you could ask the question, is it a normatively, you could, so empirically, this is clearly true. You'll see statistics like, you know, like top 10 programs, you know, their PhD, the PhDs that produce their faculty are highly concentrated. You know, some programs have never hired a PhD below a certain rank of program and so forth. So empirically, the focus on elites is there. You just have to deal with it. Empirically, you could ask the question whether that's justified. So, for example, you could say maybe it's a good thing that we focus on elites because there's a self-selection, right? You know, the students who go to the most elite programs like Michigan or Princeton or Harvard or Stanford or something, or Wisconsin, you know, they're more likely to be the strongest students. So don't be surprised if they produce the best work and have the best career outcomes. Or you could be a big believer that, you know, that's just kind of a status game where, you know, that's less correlated with some underlying value. But for a lot of issues, that's really not germane, right? So even if you believe in the self-selection issue, you certainly must believe that the correlation is not perfect. You know, there are certainly good people who go to a more modest school, and you certainly want to reward them for doing good work. You know, shouldn't it all be at the top? So then when it comes to questions of how to manage the academy, right? Like, how do we run our business? You know, are we doing it fairly or unfairly? You know, these empirical questions become important. And then you have to ask, if you care about an issue, what's the easiest way to solve it? So for example, in the blog post, I talk about racial and gender diversity. People say, well, if you look at the, strong programs, they're disproportionately too many whites, maybe a disproportionately low number of African Americans, Latinos. How do you address that? How do you fix that? There are many ways you could do it. So for example, you could say, take all Latino students and give them extra mentoring or training and whatnot. Or you could say, well, look at the Latinos or African Americans who are elite programs and help them out the most, or figure out what it is about the elite programs that they are not giving to students of color or women and focus on that. And if you care about efficiency in terms of your policy, that's the way to go. You would say, okay, where is the place? If you really care about diversity, And you know that most of the best jobs are going to people from certain strata of programs, then you could go for the lower ranked programs, but you kind of know that that's going to be a very low reward effort. Or you could focus on the most elite programs where you know a priori, those people are very likely to make it through the job application process. And as I wrote in my post, it doesn't mean that I don't think good people are found all over the place or whatnot, but you have to choose your battles. You know, their time budgets, their money budgets, their constraints to human action. And if you really care about racial diversity, what it means is that, you know, you should really focus on making sure students of color in the top programs at the top couple of schools, that they're more likely to survive. And one of my points is not just survive, but to make vital connections with senior faculty who are often producing the co-authoring opportunities that lead to the best jobs. Because it's,
okay, so,
yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Leslie, please.
So I have 2 points. So the first is, you know, I mean, we definitely see it in sociology, but I mean, I think that it's something that's part of academia more broadly. Yep. I mean, I remember being when I was a graduate student, I was on graduate student government, and I remember having a meeting with the then president of Princeton, Shirley Tilghman. And I remember her saying, well, you know, we were talking about diversifying faculty. And I remember her saying, well, you know, you might have someone who does some really interesting work at like this institution, but I mean, but if no one's ever heard of it, I'm sorry, it's just that person's just not going to get hired. So I kind of feel as though sociology departments are taking cues from the administration of whatever institution they're within more broadly and saying, hey, our deans will be more likely to support this candidate if, you know, if he or she like has this certain pedigree. That's number one. And my second point is that, you know, while it might be great to focus on students of color, in particular at elite programs, I want to push back a little bit because sure. It has not been my personal experience that because you're a student of color, that or graduate student of color, that faculty decide that they have a commitment to mentoring you in the way that I kind of feel like I hear you're saying this mentorship is happening.
Ah, so let me clarify that point. So first of all, I actually agree with you, and that's why I want to clarify the point, which is the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, the recipe for success in academia is difficult, but fairly clear. You want to go to a school with a good reputation, ideally a top 5 school, but usually most faculty actually come from maybe the top 20 or 30 programs in their discipline. But on top of that, you need the right publication. And often these publications are mentored or assisted by faculty. And you'd be surprised if you look at R1 programs or very selective liberal arts colleges, you see a lot of junior faculty with co-authors who are faculty members. But one of my issues, I've actually written about this on the blog, is that those opportunities are not going to students of color. So if your experience is that you weren't getting that help, I would humbly suggest that you're not alone. You know, a lot of people in your position have certainly felt that way. And so, you know, so that makes me think, you know, like, what is the issue? And my judgment, having now been through the entire academic ladder, like I've gone from grad school to full professor, is that, you know, success is really about the core of the publishing faculty at top programs extending opportunities for publication to students. That is, yeah, there are a couple of lone geniuses who can go out there and just publish in the top journals. They do exist. They'll be fine. But 9 times out of 10, you will see, you know, the top junior faculty with a nice with a couple of good publications, even if it's not a top journal, but like some sort of reasonable publication with the faculty. And so my opinion now is that one of the reasons that we see an underrepresentation, not just in sociology, but in most disciplines, is that it's not enough to get Black students or Latino students into the graduate programs. That's simply not enough. We know that. We have 30 years of data. We now know that's enough. What it is once you walk into the door, you need a senior faculty member to say, can you work on my research project? Can you co-author this? And I will say bluntly, that did not happen to me. I have zero co-authored publications from my graduate school faculty. Not that they were horrible people or anything. I'm not implying that. But as a fact, that's what happened. And I've noticed that a lot of students of color, when they are successful, are often solo authors on stuff. So what that means is there's going to be a relative underproduction. And for some reason, those opportunities are not being extended throughout the graduate cohort. So I think I actually agree with you, Leslie, on your basic point. And my point was simply that it's not that everybody gets these opportunities, but the people who tend to succeed have a lot of these opportunities. That was my point.
Can I push back on this a little bit? Because
please.
From my perspective, I felt like there is a narrow view of the profession underlying sort of the general commentary. And if you go to the top 10 schools, or if you're talking about elite jobs, what are we talking about? We're talking about a universe of maybe a dozen lightly read publications, NSF grant making, and the quest for faculty positions. Maybe there's 150, 200 at 10 institutions. And this is occurring in a broader field where there's probably tens of thousands of people who think that they're sociologists and work in some capacity as a sociologist. And one of my concerns is when we sort of narrow our conception of what the discipline does, where things matter to those 10 journals, those 10 schools, and NSF grant making, we're not only sort of cutting off young people from considering other really viable and probably equally high impact lines of work. Like if your student goes and works at the Census Bureau, ultimately their net impact on society by virtue of their research is probably comparable or probably greater than what you would get from a run-of-the-mill sociologist, right? We all individually have, in my perception, is quite a minor impact on the general conversation. We pop through once in a while in the newspaper for a few weeks, each of us does, a few times in our career. But that maybe when we're focusing on sort of this narrow range, we're reinforcing a system where I think we're reinforcing maybe a disciplinary culture where we're not pushing our students towards other forms of work. We're not valorizing other types of thought or discussion that takes place on other venues.
Can you define narrow range?
A narrow range would be, it's what I would think of as research that would get published in the top journals and major grants, NSF or something like that.
Yeah. So let me respond by saying that, you know, whenever you make any choice about how you run an institution, like graduate programs, you have to always ask yourself, what is the goal? So in that original blog post, I picked on the issue of, you know, diversifying the faculty, right? And academia has a very narrow definition of quality. It's one that I kind of agree with, may not completely, but I'm kind of in line with it. You know, I think journals are valuable. I think books are valuable and academic research is valuable. However, if you say I have more than one goal or I have different goals, then of course the policy is going to shift, right? So for example, if you really want to diversify the faculty, I think my suggestion is not a crazy one, that you have to really talk to the incumbent faculty members and ask them, why aren't there more Black co-authors, Black research assistants on your projects? However, if the issue is you just want to produce high quality researchers, they'll go to the private sector, that will go to, you know, the U.S. Census, which you mentioned, which is a great line of work to be in, then the policy will shift. So, for example, if the goal of your graduate program, hypothetically, is to train people for the Census Bureau, then publication is really a moot point. And then it might be just a simple matter of fact of immersion in basic applied statistics. And in fact, one of the nice things about the program where I teach at now, Indiana University, is that we have had people go to the Census Bureau, and they've been very much helped by this really relentless focus on basic applied stats that we have at Indiana. And it's just a different thing. And you just have, at the beginning of every conversation, you have to just say, what's the goal? And right. That helps you clarify. And then you're right. If the goal is, working at Facebook, working at the census, working for the school district, doing policy reports, then of course the training is going to change and the goals are going to change. And I'll even tell individual students this, like if you want a job like Fabio's job, then yeah, you're going to have to slog through this for 5, 6, 7 years and get the pubs. But if you want to go work for an NGO, you should quit tomorrow. Like just get your master's degree, quit tomorrow, wrap it up. I'm a big believer in completing things. So complete your master's degree, but that takes like a couple of months, not years. And then goodbye, go to DC or San Francisco and pursue that line of work. My skill set is not going to help you get a foothold in that world very well. Mm. So I think I agree with your general point that I'm speaking in a very narrow range, but I'm speaking as an academic who cares about the health of academia. I wasn't speaking from the perspective of, you know, shifting the goals of my department or some other department.
Well said.
But do you think that type of approach suppresses the development of maybe a practical sociology or pushes the ASA to maybe ignore our colleagues who work at teaching institutions? I'm thinking more in terms of a general cultural disposition, elitism in sociology. Not necessarily one that disparages our colleagues, but views the relevant universe of sociology as occurring within 20 departments and maybe, you know, 5 or 6 publishers.
Right. So I have a couple of responses to that, which is that if your issue is, say, application versus basic academic research, we already have a good solution. It's called the Public Policy School. And they provide fabulous training. They will get you those kinds of jobs. And for example, like here's a key difference. If you work at a school of public policy, part of your packet for promotion will often include not just research, teaching, and service, but also public service. You have to show that you've done something concrete for some constituency outside of academia, and that could be flexible, but you have to do something, right? Mm-hmm. So if your question is, what about things that aren't purely academic or basic knowledge in nature? The answer is, we already have that. Okay. Then if your question is, how can we make the ASA or whatever professional sociology is more friendly to a wider range of people in different kinds of academic positions, you know, I think there's not one strategy, right? So you could do one thing, like you could have publications that focus on those people. For example, we have Teaching Sociology, that's an ASA journal. We have Contexts. Even this podcast is a really great example of that, which is like, we're going to talk in this conversation and with your other guests on other programs. Mm-hmm. They will talk about stuff that's very accessible that you could show an undergraduate and would make for an excellent classroom discussion, right? Mm-hmm. And that's okay. But if you're talking about things like leadership, who gets to write the high impact stuff, mm-hmm. who gets to direct the nature of science and the scholarly enterprise, not always, but disproportionately, that is an elite game. And it's like going into the NFL and saying, I wish we'd stop talking about Tom Brady. The answer is, you're going to talk about Tom Brady because he's the best at what he does. And the teams you should talk about are the top 5 or 10 teams. They set the agenda in pro sports. Go ahead, please.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there. All right. So wait, but then I have, but then, oh, the last question I'll ask.
Sure.
Do you think then that there are ethical issues if a sociology doctoral program accepts students and they don't have a high tenure track placement rate? Should they just be sending students to public policy schools if they can't put their grad students on the tenure track?
I don't think it's an ethical issue. I think what each department has to do, because really nothing is written in stone, right? The people who staff that program, they have to have a conscious choice about what they're going to do. And then if they're upfront and honest about it, that is ethical. So let me give you an example, a real world example. There are many programs in this country in sociology that do not offer PhD degrees. Instead, they offer master's degrees, right? And the classic question that comes up in these programs is, should we be training our students for PhD programs? Should this be a stepping stone program from the master's level to the doctoral level? Or alternatively, is this a stepping stone to industry or to the public sector world of work? And if you tell people up front what you're trying to do, then that is completely ethical. It is completely ethical to say, look, sociology is a wonderful academic tradition. There's a lot of excellent things that happen in it. You can get a decent job in policy if you learn some basic stats, you read some social theory, you read some demography, experimental design, or whatever. And that's the package we're giving you, because that package is tailored towards the career goals we're trying. Now, of course, if you want to do academia, we can help you too. But that's not the number one goal of our program. And same thing with doctoral programs. Like, who says you can't have a doctoral program that's more applied in flavor, long as you are open about it? You know, same thing with academia. You know, if you have an academically oriented PhD program, there's nothing wrong with that, long as you're open about it. And I think this really speaks to the issue that many academic programs, which is they often don't have an internal culture of debate where they talk about what really the goal of the program is. Instead, you get hired there, you close the door to your office and you do your research and you hope for tenure. But instead, you know, departments should really be open. And every couple of years at the review or internal assessment, they should say, look, you know, what are we really trying to do here? And it's okay to switch missions. But, you know, develop that idea of what you're doing and tell people up front, like, this is a department about public policy, or this is a department about academic research. And then that's ethical. That's fine with me.
Yeah. And, you know, just to follow up again on this sort of this idea about the sort of focus on elite institutions. I mean, that our country seems to be obsessed with elite institutions, right? Right. So why wouldn't sociology as a discipline also be totally obsessed by elite institutions? I mean, hey, we could use that as a segue into, you know, the whole Harvard lawsuit, if you'd like, right? This fetishization of this one institution.
We're not that kind of show. We use guitar riffs to separate segments. Stick to the format. Yes, that the format also works. Yeah.
So, yeah, I have been fascinated by the way in which this lawsuit that has been brought against Harvard by a group of primarily Asian American students. So basically, the lawsuit against Harvard that started out, you know, not just contending that the admissions process was unfair and actually racially discriminatory against Asians, but also, you know, including the fact that, you know, affirmative action was something that should have actually been also put on the chopping block, or should also have been put under review as something that disadvantages Asian students. It seems that the judge basically said, sorry, you got to throw out that affirmative action thing because, you know, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, it's totally fine. So now the lawsuit is going forward without the argument against affirmative action, but with the argument that, okay, the whole admissions process at Harvard University is in many ways designed to disadvantage Asian students as compared to white students. And so maybe we just need to burn shit down. And so that's my understanding of how this lawsuit has progressed.
You know what I loved about that was they managed to pinpoint quantitatively where in the application process they were penalizing Asian students. And I guess it came in the likability rating. So there was like a statistically identifiable penchant for admissions officers to rate Asians as less likable.
Well, it's not just likable. It's like on a key of personality trait. Yep. So likability, but also things like courage and I'm just like, you know, if you want to get in trouble, like, you should have criteria like that in your admissions process. I'm sorry.
But isn't it sort of instructive? Like, I wonder, were everybody forced to quantify their decision-making process? Like, that's probably where a lot of minorities or groups that have experienced prejudice, they do get dinged, is in the mind of maybe somebody who's racist. They're like, great, great resume, not likable, or some type of soft characteristic like that.
So here's my thing, right? So one of the things that really fascinates me about this lawsuit is this idea that people in the public have that, number one, this is a meritocracy, and that, number two, even if it is a meritocracy, merit is whatever the hell we decide it is, right? Especially at a private institution, right? So, I mean, I interact with students all the time who are like, this was my SAT score, this was my GPA, and I didn't get into Harvard, I didn't get into Princeton. And then I ask them, and so who told you that you were entitled just because you got those two things? And that is something that, you know, at I don't know, I hope that at least at the end of the day, the two things will happen, right, as a result of this lawsuit is, number one, you know, we kind of demystify, right, these institutions a little bit, and also maybe the halo, right, that is bestowed on people who get accepted to and graduate from these institutions, you know, that'll be tarnished a little bit, right? In that, and when I say tarnished, I basically just mean that, like, you know what? You're really not that much better, right, than a lot of other people, at least not just simply based on these criteria that you think are universal criteria that entitle you to a place at one of these institutions. That's number one. And then also number two, I'm hoping that in some ways we will be revisiting the admissions process to some degree. I'm just hoping that this isn't, as some people claim, just kind of a way to opening the door to ending affirmative action.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to say about the Harvard lawsuit. And while you were speaking, I actually looked up one of my favorite posts on my blog called The Dim Kids of the Ivy League. Okay. And The Dim Kids of the Ivy League is a blog post where I discovered that the Educational Testing Service published a report showing that a non-trivial fraction of students at Ivy League schools simply just don't belong there. And I will quote from their findings. Researchers with access to closely guarded admissions data found that, on the whole, about 15% of freshmen enrolled at America's highly selective colleges are white teens who failed to meet their institution's minimum admission standards. So one out of seven kids at Harvard or Princeton simply do not meet the qualifications that are posted on the door. And later, another researcher who had done some research on Ivy League admissions policies tweeted this out about a year and a half ago, a tweet that said 41% of the freshman class at Harvard is legacy. That does not mean that they all don't deserve to be there. So maybe they were stellar students, but they also had a grandparent who went to Harvard or something like that. But I think what these kinds of research show is that there's always been a big massaging by the admissions office of who gets into highly selective schools. Probably the best discussion of this is from a book called The Chosen by Jerome Carabel, which is literally 800 pages long, big, thick doorstop of a book.
I love that book.
But is one of the most historically intense investigations of Ivy League admissions practices. And you can see during the entire 20th century history of these elite schools that, you know, there was great attention paid to the ethnic composition. Originally, it was an attempt to keep Jewish students out. Then it was an attempt to keep Asian students out. And then you discover that the admissions process is complicated. It's not just affirmative action. It's not just, you know, black admits going from, say, 3% to 5% or something like that. It's also legacies. It's also the well-roundedness criteria. There's also the docket system, which everybody seems to overlook, but which is important. And the docket system is when they don't judge each application by itself, but they judge them according to which state they were from. That mm-hmm. was instituted in order to keep, to minimize the number of Jewish students from New York right. and New Jersey. So they would say, well, we need geographical diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So for decades, probably even a century now, we have very concrete evidence that these institutions are really massaging and shaping the people who get in. And that reminds me of a book written by a couple of ed school researchers. Leslie triggered this memory. It's called Crafting a Class. Crafting a Class.
Yes.
And the idea is very simple, which is you're an admissions officer. you can't just assign a number based on SAT. There are all these political considerations from outside the school and inside the school, and you have to craft a class. You have to have it make it look the right way for it to be acceptable. So after reading this, I realized, my God, are people truly prepared for an elite college campus that would be based only on SATs and GPAs? And I tell people, for example, do you want Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and Michigan and Princeton to look like Caltech, which is now over 50% Asian, right? Or Berkeley?
And the other thing I would add is, like, I mean, I think a large part of why you want to get into Harvard in the first place is this kind of the sort of culture and the ethos that you think Harvard represents. And that includes the ability to hobnob and rub elbows with the children of these influential people or with Natalie Portman or whatever actor or actress, right, got in that year, with all of these sort of what they call development admits, right? You know what I mean? If those people weren't admitted, would Harvard be as shiny an object, right, as it is, number one? And number two, would Harvard have the would Harvard have the money that Harvard has without actually admitting in quite a few students from very, very wealthy families, in large part because they're from very wealthy families?
Harvard might, Duke would not. So in Price of Admission, it talks about various schools, especially in the 80s and 90s, doing development admits. And apparently Duke was the most aggressive at this. And, you know, it really took them from kind of a lower ranked regional school to, you know, one of the top 20 research universities in the country. I want to second that The Chosen is a great book. And, you know, I see the big theme of The Chosen is that well-roundedness was effectively an intentional, what do you call the type of, discrimination law, adverse, you know, something that has like an indirect effect.
Right, adverse effects, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, it was that by design, right, that they deliberately tweaked it because most of the
disparate impact.
College presidents. Yeah, disparate impact. Thank you, yes. Exactly. Yeah, so it was disparate impact by design. Right. Most of them were not willing to have overt quotas to restrict Jewish enrollment, but they tried to find other ways to effectively get to that outcome. And that is fundamentally why we have well-roundedness. Although, you know, I went back about a year ago and reviewed The Chosen, and one of the things that struck me was actually how brief the period of open meritocratic admissions was. Where it was, you know, so there was this very brief period where, so originally, you know, for like 200, 300 years, the Ivy League was based on, you had to come from certain prep schools and you had to speak Latin and Greek. And then they dropped the Greek requirement and started offering things that were kind of early precursors to the SAT. You still had to speak Latin, right, but at the time, most good public high schools taught Latin. And they found that there was this huge influx of Jews, and that period lasted something like 10 years. It was really short. And then after that, they started saying, like, well, we need to make sure we have enough kids from Montana, and we have to make sure that, you know, we have kids who are, you know, basically almost explicitly, just like this current lawsuit, you know, that who have a good personality, who represent, you know, club men and, you know, all that sort of thing. So it was a very brief period that it was basically all test scores. The other thing I would talk about is, like, I believe as Fabio mentioned, oh, here's this percentage of kids with low SATs and here's this percentage of kids who are legacies. For my money, the best work on comparing all the things systematically that go into admissions was Espen Shade and Chung. And then a follow-up article by Espen Shade, Chung, and Walling. Because actually, this is how you do it. You just take all these things, you throw them in a logit, and you see what the coefficients are. Right. I mean, we wouldn't settle for crosstabs or anything else because we know that some of these things are correlated with each other and everything like that. And it turns out that all those things matter. Right. You know, your high school GPA matters, your SAT matters, your race matters. And specifically, they found that blacks have the highest log odds of getting in, controlling for everything else, then Latinos, then whites, and then Asians are below whites. You know, that is, so they had evidence that relative to whites, Asians are discriminated against by the admissions process, holding everything else constant. There's also an athletic bonus and there's also a legacy bonus. If I remember correctly, I don't have it right in front of me. The legacy bonus was a little bit smaller than some of the race or athletic bonuses. And they did the math. And then in the second article, the one that had Walling on it, I think it was the one that had Walling. One of them had, anyway, the second article, they did kind of a predicted simulation type thing where they just took the coefficients and said, what if you got rid of affirmative action but kept legacy and athletics? What if you got rid of all three? You know, and they found that what would end up happening in this kind of, you know, just based on SAT and GPA type world, the counterfactual is that the number of whites would stay about the same, the number of Asians would go way up, and the number of blacks and Latinos would go way down. And that does seem to be the logic that you see reflected in the Harvard lawsuit, that framing it as effectively affirmative action is bad for Asians, which is consistent with what Espenshade found. Although there's a big caveat there in that Espenshade published that stuff about 15 years ago, and the data is from about 20 years ago. I believe it was the 1997 entering cohort.
Yeah. So I really love Gabriel's point about how, you know, going to a straight GPA kind of numerical system would provide a certain profile. And that, and compare that to Leslie's comment saying that, you know, part of the privilege of going to these schools is you get to hobnob with the right people and you get the social connections. And, you know, in response to that kind of observation, I once wrote an article called "Do You Want a Meritocracy? You Can't Handle a Meritocracy." Mm. And, you know, I tell people, like, you know, like, you know, is Harvard willing to go into a world where like 55% of its students are Asian or something like that? You know,
or is Harvard willing to go into a world where you get points deducted because possibly part of the reason why you have such a high SAT score is because your family has a lot of money and has been able to afford to help you figure out how to get really high test score, right?
A lot of this
has to do with, you know, how do we define merit, right? And if merit is, right, your SAT score, then how do we then do a better job of trying to predict what actually goes into your getting a high SAT score? There's some people who get high SAT scores because they're just really good test takers. There's some people who get high SAT scores because they've been going to like the shadow school system since they were in second grade. There's some people who have high SAT scores because their parents have been able to, you know, sort of surround them with educational material and culturally rich materials in their homes the entire time. So, I mean, I think all of that goes into like, why is the SAT the holy grail of what constitutes a meritocracy? And if that's what it is, how much of that merit can that individual student claim as having won for themselves? And how much of it has to do with their family?
Go ahead.
Yeah, so a couple points on that. Number one, you're implicitly defining merit as the residual. Right. You're almost saying, like, let's figure out how well you did in high school, what goes into your college application essay, and then we're going to control for your family background and then find the residual. And this is like your willpower or something like that. And I see the logic of that, like if you're trying to figure out who made the most with what they're given. But on the other hand, if you're just saying, like, who has the most accomplishments, at a certain point, it kind of doesn't matter where they came from. And that's like a deep philosophical thing of, do you want to look at the residual or do you want to look at why? Now, in terms of this, because you're a sociologist and a good one, and particularly, you know, education, you're not doing the thing I often hear from people of like, oh, it's all test prep. Test prep accounts for like 30 SAT points. It's nothing. You know, but my real thing with this is people talk about how the SAT is correlated with family income, which it is. It has a fairly high correlation with family income, as if everything else didn't. You know, right. As if, you know, you founded a nonprofit while you were in high school is not a sign of extreme privilege. And by the way, one that is much easier to buy than a high SAT score, right? You can pay you can pay for all the tutors and that sort of thing to send your dumbass rich kid to SAT prep, and they're still going to get, you know, 1,100 points on the SAT because the tutors only account for about 30 points. But you can very easily go to a college admissions consultant, have them set up a charity in your kid's name, collect some checks from your friends, and have them, you know, work at a soup kitchen for 2 hours a weekend for, you know, the 3 months before application. And that's like something that you could just flat out buy.
And write your essays as well.
Yeah, and write your essays as well. So like I fundamentally see it as this logic of you're never going to get away from class reproduction, ever. The only thing I've ever seen, the only circumstance I've ever seen where you can get away from class reproduction is during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, class background as an intellectual had no advantage for getting into college. Class background as a party cadre did, but they admitted the kind of upper middle class intellectual professional class advantage. Now, I'm not saying like, oh, anyone who cares about inequality is a malice. That's not my point. But I'm saying like that is the only circumstance, which is an extreme circumstance, like basically a collapse of civilization type circumstance where you could eliminate class reproduction. Anything else, any criteria you could come up with, the upper class will game it, right? If you say we think SAT is correlated with with background income, which it is, so we'll switch to, you know, how much charity did you do as a high school student? That's ridiculous. That's easy to game. It's trivial to game. All the well-roundedness stuff, if anything, is much easier to game than the test scores.
You know, I was reading the Times article and listening to what you say, and I'm wondering how much of class reproduction is a bug as opposed to a feature of these high-end schools. Like I remember in the Times article on this, the article was talking about how Harvard admissions counselors were wary of admitting a lot of engineers or computer scientists because they would probably end up opting to go to MIT or Caltech. And those are more skills-oriented types of degrees. And a lot of the programs that we're discussing deal in humanities and soft skills, where maybe the transmission and acquisition of cultural and cultural capital and social capital is what's being sold ultimately. So it's like, is Harvard about selling skills and amassing the best, or is it is what it's really selling connections and the aura of being a Harvard graduate?
Yeah, let me take a moment to also step in. That's a great point, and to defend SATs a little bit. So I agree 100% with Gabriel that they're probably the hardest thing to game amongst the things you might include. But also the other thing to remember is that we do actually care at least a little bit about what people do in college, right? Like when they show up, we want them to be able to pass their classes and have an enjoyable academic experience. And of all the things we have, SATs are actually the best predictor of that. A lot of academics think the SATs have no predictive validity for college performance. That's actually not true. What they do is they predict the first year or so of your college experience pretty well, which kind of makes sense, right? Because you take them in your last year of high school, your first year of college is still kind of similar to your high school program. And then later on, the effects go away. I'm not sure why, but my theory is that people just sort into the majors they're good at. But the point is, you know, if you actually care at all about people doing well academically, you know, doing well on a standardized test is probably not a crazy way to do that. Not only is it harder to game than the other stuff, but in terms of validity, like there's a lot of research, like letters of recommendation have no predictive value in the future at all. They just don't. And so,
well, at least they're not time consuming to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Fabio, I mean, I'm not trying to say that the SATs don't have any predictive validity. What my understanding, though, in the studies that I have shown is that there's actually a cutoff point, right? After which, you know, 10 more points, 50 more points, 100 more points doesn't offer you greater predictive validity, right? So this idea that you can just take the average scores of a certain group and say, well, this group on average, like, did better. And so hence, you know, they're being penalized for it. I'm pretty sure, and I say this from actually having been on at least one admissions committee myself, is that there is, like, I mean, there's generally a, like, kind of a floor that they have where they say, okay, like, at this point, we think kind of like everyone who did this well and above, you know, we're putting them in the same pool, and then we'll see what else they have to offer.
Yeah, that's a pretty valid point. And, you know, there's no a priori reason to say, you know, there might be a threshold effect or a hurdle effect, and to say maybe what college admission should be really something like, you know, we're not going to accept anybody below a certain cutoff, but, you know, but beyond that, we look for other things. And once again, I'm still a little wary because even though, you know, there may be cutoff points for SAT tests, that's still better than like letters of recommendation or some of these other signals. I think the question is always like, what's the alternative? You know, what is the thing we would do instead of this? You know, and they all have costs. And as was pointed out, you know, if you go to an all GPA standardized test score format, you'll get too many engineers, and that produces one kind of class. And if you want people who will be in the future elite, that produces another kind of class. And maybe this gets back to an earlier section of this podcast, which is when you're running an institution, you have to ask what your goal is, and you can't do everything. You can't produce the best engineers in the world at the same time as you're producing the world's social elites. Those are incompatible in most cases.
And now we turn to Fabio Rojas from Indiana University. Fabio is co-editor of Context Magazines and blogs at Org Theory. He's best known for his book, From Black Power to Black Studies, How a Radical Social Movement Became an Academic Discipline, with Johns Hopkins University Press. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us, Fabio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
For those of us who don't know From Black Power to Black Studies, can you give us a brief overview of the book?
Sure. The book is about the rise of a discipline that we now call African American Studies or Africana Studies. And the main question of the book is, how did a student movement essentially get to become an academic discipline? How did that transformation occur? And so the book does a couple of things. First of all, it's historical. It's an actual bona fide history book. I believe that you know, that book is among the first to chronicle the rise of Black studies from its roots in 1966 all the way up to the present. It is also a book of organizational sociology, which answers the question, how do organizations respond when protesters challenge them? And then thirdly, it's also a book on disciplinary formation. If you have all these things happening in a university, how they pull together into a thing that we call a discipline. And so From Black Power to Black Studies presents as evidence as in kind of a process. There's like the beginning of the discipline, the protest that happened, the response of the administrators of the university, then the actual construction of the discipline by assembling scholars from all kinds of other different departments into programs and discussing their ups and downs, like when are they stable and when they're not stable. And that's the book.
All right.
So one part that was especially interesting in that, and I've read the book, although I read it when it came out like 10 years ago, is you talked about the formation of a discipline. So right. Not just departments, not just how to, but the formation of a discipline.
Right.
And, you know, a little bit of a timely thing and plays off a conversation we had last week, which unfortunately Leslie couldn't be here for, on the Sokol Squared hoax, which was not aimed at Black studies. It was mostly right. Aimed at gender studies. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot in common, and people very often refer to them as the studies fields. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one reading of that, and the one that was basically intended, is that the studies fields have a bullshit problem. So, you know, and my personal opinion is that the kinds of issues that are studied within the studies fields are completely legitimate and important issues for research. And we should absolutely, you know, we talk about gender in novels, but we should do it in English departments. And we should talk about, you know, race and the history of racism and the history, you know, we should talk about the history of, you know, racial schema and, you know, in the caste system in Spanish colonial America and that sort of thing. But we should do it in the history department. Or, you know, skin tone and life attainment, but we should do it in a sociology department because I think the disciplinary perspective is valuable. So you know, how, you know, given that you've studied the history of one of these interdisciplinary fields coming in and trying to develop itself as a discipline, how success, first of all, how much has that simply happened, right? Is it the case that people in Black Studies departments have Black Studies PhDs, or are they all historians and English PhDs and that sort of thing? And second of all, how successful is an intellectual enterprise do you think it's been?
Right. So, you know, we know the answer to the first question pretty clearly. Then, of course, the second question is open to debate. But in terms of the question of, like, you know, in what sense are they a discipline? And by discipline, you mean a group of scholars that's institutionalized in the university system that is able to reproduce itself over time, mainly through PhD programs and journal publications. So Black Studies is somewhat successful, but maybe not as successful as most people think. Just to give you a couple of numbers, when I published the book, about 120 universities in the United States had a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral program in Black Studies. At that time, maybe there are only about 6 or 7 PhD programs. They do have their own journals. I've published myself in the Journal of Black Studies, Souls, and some other Black Studies journals. So we know from just this basic data that, you know, it is somewhat institutionalized as a discipline. It is not self-reproducing at this stage. So, for example, even today, most people who teach in African-American studies programs have their PhDs from history departments or economics or psychology or whatever. So we know that. And part of the reason that that is true is that the field, when it was initially founded, was mainly institutionalized as an interdisciplinary undergraduate teaching unit. Mm-hmm. So the modal typical Black Studies program is not a PhD program. It is a small program with, say, 2 or 3 full-time tenure lines, supplemented by adjunct or part-time faculty borrowed from history or Spanish or some other area. And they intentionally did not have PhD programs.
Oh, and just to clarify, by part-time, you don't mean that this person only works at the university 20 hours a week. You mean it's like a split FTE.
Oh, yes, thank you. Right. So split FTE. So you know, you might be jointly appointed in, you know, history and at Black Studies, and also supplemented by a large number of adjuncts. So, for example, I am actually an adjunct professor in African-American and Africa Diaspora Studies. That's the title of our program here at Indiana. And they have not called upon me yet, but should they ever need an extra teacher for like an intro course or whatever, I'd be happy to fill in. I'm very supportive of what they do. But your question of, you know, in what sense is it a discipline? The answer is like in the middle. It's not a fully autonomous discipline like sociology, where we essentially reproduce ourselves over time. It is not in the realm of what you might call interdisciplinary studies, which literally has no PhD programs, and, you know, not, there aren't like core journals where everything happens. It's kind of somewhere in the middle. Then your second question, what is the quality or how good is the scholarship there? Then what you have to do in order to answer that question is you have to say things like, what is the citation impact? That's one way to measure quality, or the reputation of the journal. And I actually published a short article in the Journal of Black Studies about this. And what you discover is that there seems to be two types of Black Studies professors, and at least in the PhD programs that award it. You have disciplinarians who publish in like American Sociological Review or American Historical Review or whatever. And essentially, most of their academic reputation comes from the disciplines, and that tends to be very high impact. And then there are people who establish their credentials mainly within the publication venues of the world of Black Studies, such as the Journal of Black Studies or the Western Journal of Black Studies. And those will have necessarily much smaller impacts. And then also, I'll be upfront as well, which is there are some schools of Africana studies or Black studies that honestly make me scratch my head. So, for example, there's something called Nile Valley Scholarship, which made some outrageous claims about the origins of Western civilization. So that exists in the same world as, say, somebody like Skip Gates, who is considered probably to be one of the leading literary critics of his time, or other leading figures. And they all are Black Studies professors in some degree, and some of them are super high quality, and some of them, let's just say, a little bit dodgy. Got to be careful with some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's more or less, it's funny that your answer so heavily emphasized, you know, essentially organizational perspectives, but of course it makes sense because you're an organizational sociologist. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what you're saying all made sense to me, and including the part towards the end where that's also been my own impression that, you know, colleagues who have a split FTE between a disciplinary department and an interdisciplinary department, you know, obviously sociology is going to be the most salient to me. They do good work, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, it's great that, you know, we basically got half the FTE for free and we get to have this colleague who's doing work I like. But then when I see the stuff that seems to happen more where that's its home, you know, not kind of split with a traditional discipline, it seems to be a little less, you know, and like you said, it can get downright weird, like the Afrocentrist pseudoscience.
Well, I mean, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, sure. right? Mm-hmm. Like, just in terms of what you mean by Afrocentrist, right?
Oh, because... I meant what he was talking about with Nile Valley stuff, the idea that the Greeks got all their culture from the Egyptians.
Okay, all right.
I don't have any quibble with somebody studying, you know, Mali before colonialization or something like that. That's a totally legitimate history topic.
Yeah, well, I think one of the points that I want to make about African-American studies and Africana studies is, you know, for example, as a sociologist, right, you know, and you might be interested in, I don't know, studying health disparities or whatever. One of the mandates, that you have, right, as like a scholar of Africana or African American studies is to actually like place the focus on people of the African diaspora. And that's something that you tend to not see in sort of mainstream disciplines, right? So if I'm studying health disparities, you know, I might not actually care so much about, you know, the health of white people, right? Or if it's comparative, then I would make Black people the default instead of white people, right? And that's just not something that you see very, very often in mainstream disciplinary journals, right? And I think that there is actually some real value to publishing work that actually puts people from the African diaspora central to your research, right? As opposed to, you know what I mean, being some oddity, right? Or some one of these.
No,
right?
I actually don't get what you're saying because
let me give you an example.
Yeah, please.
So like for example, when you read the history of this, one thing that you'll notice is that the push for Africana studies or Black studies was particularly strong in the humanities. And there's certainly an audience for it in the social sciences, but not as strong. And the reason is that in the social sciences, even since the beginning, race has always been accepted as a thing you can talk about. Now, early in the discipline, history of the social sciences, that was done in a way we would not find acceptable today, like eugenics or something like that. But the point is, like, race is a thing you can talk about, and it gets talked about over and over and over and over. So yeah, you'll see some sociologists who are involved in the action, but the big focus of this is actually the humanities. And there, you know, it was much easier for people to say, you know, Black people never wrote a novel that was any good, right? Or, you know, basically, you know, blues is the only kind of like Black music that was ever produced or something like that. And people would say these wild things or crazy things, either to completely banish African-Americans from the discourse entirely or to extremely minimize them. And so, you know, from their perspective, what advocates would say is something very similar to what Leslie said, which is, you know, maybe Black studies will be a thing in economics or whatever, but that could be a passing fad. 10 years from now, they may move on to other topics. But by having a program, or they call it a counter space. In the book, I call it a counter center within the academy, which is you recognize as a white mainstream, they may or may not care about your topic, but it would be valuable to have a fully dedicated space to that topic that's not going to rise and fall with the trend as much.
Fabio, what was your reaction to the Sokol squared hoax? Did you think, and what was your reaction to the fallout, like the discipline's reactions? Do you think it's a meaningful event or sort of a stunt that's been overblown? How did you react?
Well, my first reaction, honestly, was, oh my God, I hope I didn't publish any of this stuff. I mean, you know, I really hope I didn't, because... you know, as a discipline that does sometimes focus on like everyday life events or something like that, or interesting subcultures, you do get in that zone. So like, oh my God, I hope I didn't publish any of this. So the answer is no, we did not publish it. Nor to the best of my knowledge, did we, approve a proposal or anything like that.
No, and not just you. I don't know whether by first person plural you mean context or you mean sociology as a whole, but in fact, sociology as a whole didn't give a single acceptor R&R to any of that crap.
Right. So when I was talking about me personally, because I was worried about Fabio.
I figured.
But Gabriel, so you also asked about responses from other people. So when I slowly read through it and I was reading the write-up they had, I was like, oh my God, please let not the ASR or AGS or Social Forces or something like, or Social Quarterly be on this list. Please God, no. And then as I saw, you know, reject, I felt a little bit better. And then I think Will Wilkinson, who is a writer, kind of a libertarianish bent, he had a series of...
That would have been true 10 years
ago. Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, but the that's kind of the
concept. Let's just call him an idiosyncratic liberal at this point.
Yes, let he's a friend of mine. Let's just say a writer I love reading. I'll say that.
Sure, and I didn't say he's a jerk. I just said that his politics have changed.
Oh, fair enough. So, so anyway, so the point is he had a really great series of tweets where he explains what is the ethos or the habitus of sociology that kind of inoculated it in this hoax. And I think the answer is simply that, you know, we value data for real, right? Just like, we're not going to fake it. We have our own inclinations. But we're actually not half bad at spotting fake data. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even on people who may agree with us, we try to gravitate towards well-designed studies rather than poorly designed studies. Doesn't always work, but, you know, we're probably like the most, like other social sciences in that respect. Then finally, the big picture takeaway, you know, I don't think it's that different from what you guys mentioned on an earlier podcast, which I was listening to this morning, which is, you know, we're in an era where there's a lot of public knowledge about the fact that academia contains a lot of nations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some people who choose to use academia as an expression of a grievance. You know, we talked about that a little bit. And then there are other people who say, yeah, I have normative commitments. I'm upfront with that. And I am upfront with my own. But at the same time, I care about data. Like, I want to be right. And if I'm wrong on something, I'd like to know that. Right. And so people who know the academy knows that there's a wide range of attitude. And maybe in the end, you know, I don't think it's going to change very much. Like, it's not going to really, you know, change the landscape of academia. But I'm just glad the sociology came out a little bit better looking than it did before. And I'm thankful that, you know, other journals run by people who I know personally made some good choices.
Well, I totally agree with what you're saying about, you know, Will's thread, which I also thought was interesting. That was more or less what I had in mind at the beginning of this segment when I was talking about, does the disciplinary perspective inoculate us? Because I don't think it's just that, you know, oh, sociology didn't fall for this, but economics would. Mm-hmm. I think it's more that the disciplinary perspectives force you to care a lot about data and care a lot about of analysis and resist pure polemic, you know, both because it is the case that about 2/3 of sociologists or maybe 60% of sociologists simply aren't interested in polemic, you know, and there do tend to be systematic tendencies among the beliefs of sociologists. But it's also the case that a strong majority of sociologists believe that those should be bracketed. That's something that you don't have in fields that their founding mission was more polemical in intent.
Yeah, the bottom line, when people ask me about the intersection of academic and public work, and we were talking about public sociology earlier, when I say something like this, I say, look, you know, you're on good grounds when you tell people that I have presented evidence to you that might appeal to you or persuade you, even if you don't already agree with me. And I think that's the key point, which is if you imagine an audience of skeptics, then you'll ask yourself, what is good and bad about this data? Or what are the limits of this data? Like, what can it prove? What can it not prove? And if your discipline or area has really absorbed that lesson and they force it down graduate students' throats all the time, you know, then then I think you're in a better position than some of these other areas of academia where they run away from evidence or they view it with skepticism, you know, and it really comes down to personal viewpoint. And I think this is one reason why a lot of people, when they go to graduate school, because they have normative commitments, bristle at graduate training, not just because graduate school is kind of a very awkward and stressful process, but basically when you go into a research method seminar, you know, and you learn about things like hypothesis testing or treatment conditions and stuff like that, you're faced with the possibility you could be dead wrong. And earlier we talked about the Black Studies book, and there was actually a section in that book that showed me that one important hypothesis I had in organization studies was wrong. It was extremely wrong. And I only got to understand it was wrong by reading page after page of historical documents and collating the data. And I realized my belief was simply incorrect. So that's what I take from the Sokol hoax. I don't think it's going to change any people's minds. The pranksters, you know, I actually almost feel sorry for the pranksters because, like, they could have gotten like a really good journal article out of that effort. Instead, they write 20 bits of crap, and I don't know how many departments are going to want to hire them later. You know, it's just like, I see what they did and I sympathize with it, but I'm not sure if that's the best use of their time on this planet. So there's that. But it did make me feel better that, you know, yeah, you know, if we care about real data, it could be qualitative, it could be quantitative, you know, but the point is there's standards and there's skepticism, and stuff that holds up after skepticism should be valued. And that's a good thing.
So I was very intrigued when you said you got something wrong. And like I said, I read the book, but I forgot. What was the hypothesis you had that was falsified?
Oh, yeah. So this comes from chapter 5 of the Black Studies book about nonprofit foundations. So there is a belief in some quarters of ethnic studies that philanthropists were trying to subvert or co-opt the area with donations. And this is also kind of a flavor of a hypothesis, which is popular in organizational studies called resource dependency theory, which basically says he who holds the cash holds the control, right? Like you have the money, you control. And so then what would the theory predict? The theory would predict that of all the flavors of Black slaves you could have had, the one that would have survived the process was the one that was favored by philanthropists. Why? Because they were giving schools $5, $10, $20 million for Black studies programs. And that's not an exaggeration. Like in 1969 dollars, they're giving about $20 million. What actually happens when you look at the data? When you actually read the history, you realize that people in the Black studies areas had very different ideas about scholarship and the management of programs than people at the foundations, like the Ford Foundation. There's even a point where they had a meeting at the Aspen Institute in Colorado, and Black activists actually asked the philanthropists who were there, the program officers, they asked them to leave the room where they had a private conversation about what the mission of Black slaves would be. And then after a while, the Ford Foundation and other nonprofits kind of gave up. They just said, okay, we're done giving grants. We're not able to get the version of Black slaves we want. And so, you know, maybe the hypothesis could be rescued, but at least the naive version of it, that simply if you give money to people, they'll do what you want, is extremely wrong. And it's a hypothesis that is very popular amongst people who study nonprofits and philanthropic giving, you know, that, you know, the person who gives the money is going to really control the arena of action. And that was just incredibly not true. There was a lot of conflict and revolt and dissent over, philanthropic donations. And that connects to a lot of other, you know, modern debates we're having now about, you know, people, you know, foundations giving money for this, that if you give money to a university, you control the university. It's like, no, that's not how life works. And I first learned that lesson when doing the research for my book. So that's an example of historical research show that one of my hypotheses, which is plain wrong.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because you came to that finding at about the same time Victoria Alexander published her AJS on museum financing.
Right.
And finding that the curators are basically able to play different funding sources off each other. So the funders don't have control, the curators do.
Yep.
And in this case, it would be the, you know, the Black Studies department chair or whatever who serves the role of the curator. And I mean, I don't want to. This is your interview, but, you know, I likewise had an experience where when I was writing my radio book, I collected a ton of data on social networks among radio stations, and I wasn't doing it to prove the null. I was doing it because I thought they would matter, but it turns out they don't matter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's my favorite finding from the book, is that networks don't matter at all for shaping diffusion.
Yeah. And I think that's the sign of any quality research, which is, you know, we could always talk about selection bias in a publication, but I think every good researcher, when they publish their book at the article, they should say, this is the one that actually survived. My other ideas all died. And I'm not showing you. And if somebody can't tell you what didn't work or what failed, there's something dodgy happening there. And you got to ask some questions like, is it really true that all your hypotheses are true? All your opinions? It's like, no, you know, lots of them are wrong. And every big project has that history where like, my God, and I can go through all my research projects and tell you about all the hypotheses that were simply not supported and were bad. My pub record would be much better, but if I could publish it, if everything were true, but that's not the way it rolls out.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. A special thank you to Fabio Rojas from Indiana University. Fabio's co-editor of Context. He blogs at Org Theory, and he wrote From Black Power to Black Studies, How a Radical Social Movement Became an Academic Discipline with Johns Hopkins. We're on the web, theannexpodcast.com, on Twitter at SocAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. On behalf of Leslie Hinkson, who had to leave early, and Gabriel Rossman, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.
Bye.